Every year, about this time, Boy Scout Troop 900 sets up their Christmas tree lot over in the parking lot, right down the street from Janet's house, on the corner of East Avenue and Hillcrest. And every year, I tell my girls the same thing. Did you guys, Becca's nodding her head yes, did you guys know that I used to work there? Did you guys know that I even slept overnight in the little wooden shack with my dad? Yeah, you tell us every year. That tree lot is an annual reminder of my time as a Boy Scout. The old days. Like when I was a brand new Boy Scout and my patrol voted me as our patrol's first patrol leader. It took one camp out for my patrol to then vote me out as first patrol leader. I was not a good leader. My leadership philosophy was pretty simple. Position gives you power. Use it, make others follow you, and things go well. And it could work if you're strong enough and willing to actually force your friends to do what you want them to. Turns out though, people don't generally like to be told what to do. And on top of that, your peers, like these were my best friends, basically just never do what you want them to. Have you noticed this? I was super bossy and my patrol just looked at me and said, nope. And like that, I was out. A few years later, I was invited to a special week-long leadership training camp through Scouts. I was the only one from our troop selected to go, and I assumed, because this is what I do, that I was chosen because I was a good leader. It never actually crossed my mind that I would be sent because I needed help learning how to become a good leader. For a semi-smart kid, I could be really slow. And so I went to this camp looking forward to like showing off my leadership skills, and I fully expected this camp full of kids who had never met me to just be impressed by me and want to name me as the leader of my team. But mostly my team that week just ignored me, and I spent most of the week kind of pouting by myself. I spent most of high school grasping for positions of power. I needed to be the leader, the president, the boss of anything, everything, right? Like I was that kid in elementary school who raced to be the line leader every single time. Line leader didn't get to do anything, but they were called a leader. By the time I graduated from high school, some of you know, I was dreaming, real dreams, of becoming president of the United States. Yes, thank you for laughing at how foolish I was. But as a brand new follower of Jesus, Jesus was already starting to unwork these things in me, to undo these things that had driven me for so long. Our passage this morning, it points to a similar experience, a leadership conflict. The leader who grasps for a position versus the leader that God is raising up. And we heard this conflict read earlier. Jesus was born in the days of Herod the king, and some wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking about someone born king of the Jews. In just a couple of sentences, the Gospel of Matthew has invited us into this powerful conflict between two rival kings. Herod is king, at least that's what he calls himself, and tells everybody else to call him as well. Of course, the Roman emperor doesn't call him king. He's just a little provincial leader, ruler at the time. If Greek, the New Testament was written in, if it had punctuation, you could see Matthew putting some air quotes around the king. See, Matthew knows that Herod isn't actually the king. Herod knows that he isn't actually the king. He's been playing king. And now some random fellows from the east, they come looking for some recently born king. And it's funny. It's funny to like put yourself in Herod's position. I try to think back to, makes me laugh a little, the times when I wanted to be the leader of something but wasn't. And I just sort of like imagine, what if I had just like pretended to be the leader anyway? Like, can you imagine the ridiculous conversations that would happen? The conflicts, if I was busy bossing everyone around and they're just ignoring me. Wait, that's what happened. Shoot. Matthew tells us, Herod's not very excited about the situation. He's troubled. And all Jerusalem with him. And we know from the story that follows, and we're going to look at it in future weeks, that trouble doesn't quite describe it, doesn't quite capture it, because he's about to go murder innocent children because of how he feels. But Herod asks the chief priests, the scribes, where this true king, the Messiah, or literally the anointed one, where is he to be born? And they, his chief priests and the scribes, they actually misquote the prophet Micah to answer him. And they say, and this is a paraphrase, from Bethlehem shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. We're going to spend the rest of our time this morning considering this misquote. Because if you look at the two passages, it's not identical. The priests and the scribes have tweaked it in some interesting ways. But Matthew is trying to show us how to read the First Testament scriptures. And I sort of need to like confess a huge fear that I have right now, jumping into this. Because have you ever tried to tell someone something funny that happened, and you're like trying really hard to get across how funny it was, and they just say, I think you just had to be there. Or, right, like, or have you ever tried telling someone a story, but you realize that you need some context and some backstory if they're really gonna like get like what happened? And so you start like filling in the gaps, but after a while you realize you're in a deep rabbit hole and the person looks really bored at your story. Like, this has the potential to be one of those sermons. Because to understand what Matthew is doing, like, we need some history and some backstory. So if I promise you, I'm only going to include relevant stuff that's important to the message. Like, will you help me by putting in some work to stay with me? I think it'll be worth it. You can tell me afterwards. Or don't. Okay. So Matthew, in our passage, tells us that the priests and the scribes say, for so it is written by the prophet. Matthew puts this gospel together, this account of Jesus. And he does it with some core beliefs, some core convictions. And one of them is that Jesus is the fulfillment of the ancient promises found throughout the Hebrew scriptures. That Jesus is the fullest satisfaction of Israel's deepest long-term yearnings and longings. And that Jesus is the wisest answer to the profound questions that God's people have been asking. And so this connection between Jesus and the words of the prophets, it is hugely important to Matthew. So important that each of the next 3 weeks we'll be looking at something that Matthew tells us was spoken by the prophets. This phrase is repeated again and again. And next week, we'll actually start reading Matthew together. If you've been reading through Immerse, if you haven't been, next week would be a great week to jump in. Just start with Matthew and discover, like, you'll hear this phrase over and over, spoken by the prophets. Matthew sees all of these things that the prophets have been speaking and writing being fulfilled in Jesus in his day. When the priests and the scribes, when they tell Herod that the king is to be born in Bethlehem, they quote from the prophet Micah. And I don't know about you, like when the last time you read the prophet Micah was. If we read the prophets, Micah tends not to be one of our go-tos. But if it's been a while, let me just encourage you. Maybe spend some time this week. If you're looking for a little bit of a slower read, just spend some time in Micah and listen to what he has to say. Because Matthew seems to think that Micah can help us make sense of Jesus and his mission and what it means when we call him king. So here's some of the backstory about Micah. Micah, he serves as a prophet when the kingdom of Israel is divided in two, right? There is a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. And Micah is a prophet in the south throughout the reigns of three different southern kings. The first king, we're told, did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh, walking in the ways of his father David. The second king did not do what was right in the eyes of Yahweh and did not walk in the ways of his father David. And the third king returned and did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh and walked in the ways of his father David. Great. So good king, not so great king, good king. But it's important to know a bit more of like what the people were living through. It's not just enough to say, well, who was their king at the time? And at the time, Assyria was a massive and powerful empire threatening the entire world. They were known for their brutality and their wickedness. Some of the very worst torture devices, modes of torture you've ever heard of come from the Assyrians. And they've now come to Israel and to Judah, and they are threatening them. Earlier this year, as a church, we read Deuteronomy together, and there we heard God promise his people, saying, if you will trust me, if you will stay close to me, if you will walk in my ways and obey my voice, God said he would protect them from foreign invaders. But if they rejected God, if they turned from his ways, God would give them over to the nations. As you read Micah, you discover quickly that neither Israel in the north nor Judah in the south is walking closely with God. And it's not the way that sometimes when we've been going through hard times, like, we sort of get distracted and just sort of forget to pray or worship. We're not talking about that. This group, this community of people have actively turned from and are rejecting God's ways, right? They have begun to actually destroy each other. They are making life hell for each other. Micah chapter 2, verse 1. Describes people laying in bed at night, planning the evil that they're going to do to others tomorrow. And then they wake up in the morning and they do it. Because, Micah says, they can. The powerful during Micah's day, they want bigger fields. And so they see their neighbor's field and they take it from them because they can. They see their neighbor's house and they take their neighbor's house. They oppress their neighbors constantly. They take the inheritances promised to their neighbors by God and they claim them for themselves. Micah says this, Micah 2 verse 8, God's people have risen up as an enemy. God's people, they take robes from people who are just walking by on the road. God's people, they push women and children out of their homes because they can. In chapter 3, Micah goes on to say that God's people are supposed to know justice. They're supposed to know what is good and right. But these people hate what is good and they love what is evil. Micah then describes a truly horrific scene of humans terrorizing and destroying their neighbors. Micah says, Jerusalem, the holy city of God, was built with blood. God's holy city has been built through sin. God's judges are being bribed. God's priests have been bought. God's prophets tell the people what they pay to hear. Micah is a prophet through one of Israel's darkest times. I mean, I hope in this moment you sense are experiencing like the sheer darkness that these people are living in. God's people are literally destroying themselves and each other, and at their borders is a massive and brutal army that's ready to finish the job. Like the waters of creation in Genesis 1 and 2, separated by God, held back by God, or the Red Sea parted by God, God's people have been protected by God's strong hand holding those waters back. God has held back the Assyrian army. God has been giving the people chance after chance to repent, to return to him. But this actually only shows how confused God's people are, because God has been busy holding back the Assyrians, God's people have been paying the Assyrians not to attack them. Even here, God's people believe that they have been saving their own lives when it's been God protecting them all along. God's people have put their trust in the Assyrians. And so God gives them over to the desires of their hearts. He gives them over to the Assyrians because that seems to be what they actually want. It's during Micah's career, his prophetic career, it's during the third southern king that Assyria stops threatening God's people, and like a flood, they collapse in on them. They begin to crush and swallow them. Systematically, the northern kingdom, Israel, is wiped out, every town and every village, until finally the capital city is captured. The northern kingdom is done. But Assyria isn't finished, and they begin to take every village, every city, until Jerusalem is the only city left. The city has been overflowing with refugees. Everyone has come to Jerusalem, trusting that the walls that for decades now they've been making thicker and thicker and higher will keep them safe from the Assyrians. But the city is not strong enough. And in a moment of clarity, his eyes are opened. The king of Judah realizes that his trust has been misplaced, that he's been trusting in Assyria not to attack. He's been trusting that his walls will be strong enough, that his armies will be strong enough. But finally, the king of Judah turns to Yahweh. He prays, and he asks for God's help, which is the thing that God has been asking, urging his people to do from the very beginning. Turn to me, trust me, call out to me. I am the only one who can rescue you. And God does exactly that. God rescues his people. The scriptures tell us that this is what God is like. That God wants to rescue his people. Matthew tells us, the Gospel of Matthew opens announcing, this is why Jesus was born, to rescue God's people from their sins. The southern kingdom, at the last moment, learned from the failure of the northern kingdom, and they turned back to God. Praise God. As you follow the story, you realize this is a miracle. God has done something. But Micah has more to say, because this turn back to the Lord isn't and won't be the last. Or this turn, their previous turn away, the southern kingdom will actually still eventually fall. After this king will be the worst king that Israel's ever had, and the people will spiral and they will destroy themselves in ways that are even worse than we've already heard. And God's people, all of them, are going to end up scattered across the earth. You can probably imagine Micah had a lot of friends. He was known for his optimism and positivity. Micah announces that the dark days that they're living in are going to get even darker. And these will be way after Micah's gone. Matthew then comes along and announces that when Jesus is born, God's people are still living in that darkness. They are still scattered across the earth. They are still struggling and they are still suffering. And God's people have been busy trying to do two things to reverse their own fortunes. They have been trying to restore Jerusalem, the holy city of God, and they've been trying to restore their kingdom, to put a rightful king of Israel on the throne in Jerusalem. If only we could do this, then our former glory would return. And this is where Micah speaks a true word of hope. I mean, think about this, right? You can imagine that restoring your capital city to greater glory and having a rightful king on the throne would give you a sense that you have been brought back. But the message from the prophets is that you are still living in darkness. If that's not a city the Lord has built, you are still living in darkness if that is not a king that has been raised up by God. And so Micah comes with a true word, a word of hope. Micah announces that a day is coming when Israel's God will begin to set everything right. It won't be on the people living in darkness to figure it out and to fix everything. God is the one who is going to turn Israel's fortunes around, but it's going to happen in a way that no one is expecting. While everyone is focused on the holy city, everyone's looking at Jerusalem, the city of the kings, while everyone is looking for the powerful king, the mighty warrior, they're trying to figure out who's going to win the battle, who is going to be the strongest. Micah announces, almost with a whisper, that a different kind of ruler is going to come out of a tiny and forgotten town. See, both Bethlehem and Jerusalem are cities of David. But which city of David is the king going to come from? Micah says that everyone is obsessed with emperors and kings and dynasties and armies and massive capitals. Men who have been raised to rule, groomed for power, who believe that they have a divine right to conquer and command. But God is going to bring forth a ruler from old. A ruler from, Micah says, from the ancient days. From Bethlehem. The place where David started as a shepherd. Where David, he cared for his sheep and he just protected them. David, he humbly served the king, refusing to take the throne for himself, even though it was promised to him in the future. David, in his life in Bethlehem, trusted God. He trusted God's plan. He walked with God and trusted God's timing. David, he wasn't in a rush to get into a certain role. And he shepherded people before he ever had a position. If you read the story of David, you discover that in his humble service, in his character, people were attracted to him. And he wasn't a king. And yet he served and shepherded humans. Micah announces hundreds of years earlier, before Judah's darkest days that one day God would undo all of the darkness. He'll start by going back to the beginning, that he'll take a shepherd from an unknown family, and this shepherd will stand and shepherd God's flock with God's strength and in God's name. And Micah says this, and I wonder if this is the longing, the hope of your heart. The people will dwell secure. He will be their peace. And notice how Micah describes these days. Micah says that swords and spears will be turned into plowshares and pruning hooks. The weapons that God's people were using against each other will now be used to feed each other and to feed their neighbors. He says that everyone is going to sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. In other words, the houses, the land that had been stolen by the rich and the powerful, it would all be returned, so that widows and orphans and foreigners and the oppressed would now have secure roofs over their head. They would be secure. The people who follow this shepherd, Micah says, they will do justice. They will love kindness, and they will walk humbly with God. In other words, those who are drawn to this ruler, to this shepherd, they will begin to live as God's people were always meant to. These are the very things that God's people were always supposed to do. The darkest days of Israel's history are no more, as people begin to see the light in Jesus and they live with him and they live in it. That's the kind of sort of declaration that ought to have us going, right? Amen. Yes, the darkness has been defeated. The light will overcome it. And yet, right, as we know, because we live, the darkness isn't gone. Just because we have found the light, the darkness doesn't disappear. Like the Assyrian empires of the world haven't disappeared. There would be Babylon after Assyria and Persia and Greece and Rome. And the earliest followers of Jesus, those who were most profoundly convinced that they had found the light, were going to be murdered by the Roman Empire. Our passage in Matthew, it tells us that Herod is going to kill the babies in Bethlehem just to get rid of Jesus, just to get rid of the light. The darkness in our world is real. And as Christians, we are called to name it as real. But when the empires of the world get darker, the light becomes all the more beautiful. If we can name the darkness, we can distinguish it so much more clearly from the light. And Micah announces that the shepherd ruler who would come will then raise up shepherds. That this is how the shepherd ruler is going to defeat the empires of darkness. That he would raise up an army of shepherds. Like, who's trembling in their boots now? The empires of the world aren't. And that's a secret plan. They're not afraid. That's okay. We're called to be the light in the midst of the darkness. The darkness can't overcome the light. We are called to be people who do justice and who love kindness and who walk humbly with God, like young David from Bethlehem. When Herod asked where the Messiah was to come from, he wanted a location. But the priests and the scribes Who knows if they meant it or did it on purpose or knew what they were even saying, but they gave him something else. They didn't just tell Herod where the king would come from, right? They told him the kind of king he would be. He would be a shepherd. And Matthew will go on to say, the shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. It took me, as a young Christian, a month of washing dishes at a camp when I wanted to be out in the front, leading publicly, showing everyone how good of a leader I am, where God started to show me that my hopes and my dreams for him, for who Jesus might be, my hopes and my dreams for who I might be, needed to be transformed. Advent. The stories of who Jesus is do this work, transforming our imaginations and our desires and our lives. God is doing something that none of us would expect on our own. But with him, it all begins to make perfect sense. I'm going to invite our team up. During communion, we're going to sing a song that, if you've ever been with us during Advent before, you know this song, you've heard it. Our benediction song will also be a familiar Advent song. And they're familiar tunes, but I just encourage you to listen to the longing and the yearning and to consider this morning what it means for Jesus to come fulfilling these deep and ancient promises, but for us to continue today to long for his return so that his promises would be made complete.